This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. From the man who gave us Rainbow Farm and Rainbow Farm 2, Impeachment and Virus comes, Woodlawn Giants. Robert Williams is back on Page Publishing, and he shares what life was like growing up in Memphis in the 70s.
My mother passed away a couple summers ago in, like, you know, the height of COVID, so we had a graveside service. So anyway, I'm one of these people. Let's celebrate the person's life. You know, you can cry somewhere else. So I did the eulogy, and I got up and I told a quick story about she had a pear tree, and she said, "Don't play by that tree." She was so proud of the finally one little pear came out, and of course we were playing ball by the tree and we knocked it out. And I said, "We can either take our whipping now or we can take it 2 days from there." You know, so I told my little brother to go get some tape, and we taped the pear back up in the tree so it looked like it was still in there. And of course it turned brown and fell. And the point is, after I go, wow, there's so many of those stories of growing up in the 60s and 70s. And the other thing is, my hometown, West Memphis, always got a bad rap. I don't know if you ever heard of the West Memphis Three, those three little boys that were killed. And, you know, they'd come to a documentary and they'd find the dirtiest street they could find. You know, these hillbilly police department down in West Memphis didn't know what to do. So I wanted to present another view of the West Memphis that I grew up in, which was, you know, a nice little world. And my family's in there, and cover, I mean, that was inspired by my dad planted these little tiny pine trees. They're almost like saplings. They were like maybe a foot tall. Those things are like 30 feet tall now. And the same artist I used to do my Rainbow Farm book, she did my cover. So she took a photograph, and it's one of the first photographs in there. It shows me and my mother in 1974. And that's what she used to make that little caricature of me. So I'm the little boy standing in there, but underneath all the trees are the names of my brothers and cousins and friends. And I did it by size. The biggest tree was a guy we called Big Phil. He was like the patriarch of our little, you know, Woodlawn gang. And then I had everyone like send me pictures, and but, you know, all my other stuff ain't working so good, but my brain still functions well and I have a pretty good memory. So I'm able to pull out all these stories.
Of short stories about you growing up in West Memphis and
the
shenanigans that went on there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And this happy days kind of a...
And things like, you know, church was big. We went to church 7 days a week when a revival was in town. But I mean, I have a great church story in there where, like, we celebrated the 10th year of our church, and they had a bunch of food outside under a tent that we were going to, you know, they do a potluck. And afterwards we were going to... And I remember in the middle of the sermon how we always thought, like, kids, you know, you remember when you're a kid, like 30 minutes seemed like forever. But that particular day, church got exciting because these two guys walked in off the street and you could smell them before you saw them. I'm like, what's going on here? What's happening in church today? And they didn't sit in the back. They walked, you know, to their credit, they walked all the way up to the front and like scooted in. And it was like a little social experiment. I started noticing how some of the elderly ladies were like, looking at them very snobbishly, you know, like, what are you doing in here? What it was, they saw that food, and they were guys that were walking towards the interstate to hitchhike. They were just bums, basically. So afterwards, you know, I'm asking my mother, I go, you know, why were those ladies looking at those men so, you know, bad? I go, I thought Jesus loved the little children, red and yellow, black and white. They're all precious in his sight, except these two guys. So she said, look, that was wrong of them because they were judging, because she says everyone is God's children. You know, then I would ask questions like, is the church a building or the people? And she told me it's the congregation, you know, building's just a building. But all kinds of stuff like that. The preacher at the church had me come and talk about the book that was at my mom's church. And so the only fan club I really have is my aunt's like art class down in Mississippi. So they love the books. And they're like, when's the next book coming out? So I went down there and, you know, did a little road trip. And I'm going back to probably do Memphis Library and West Memphis and then Marion. So I'm trying. But, you know, I'm still, I got a real job. I'm like.
I know. Working full time. It's really hard. It's really hard. Believe me. I've talked to so many authors who, you know, who try to do both. But you can do it. If anybody can do it, Robert, you can do it. Just stay with it. A 3-time hate crime survivor, Grace Felicia Lawrence, started the nonprofit Global Transgender Safety Task Force to help people navigate a world that often does not understand them. The name of the book, Stayin' Alive, a Transgender Safety Guidebook.
We do have a lot of youth and babies coming out as trans, somebody needs to go back to the drawing board. So I'm 55, and if we don't pass on the knowledge as trans women that we learn for the youth and the young adult who just coming out, they wouldn't be able to keep themselves safe. So I got together with our team, and there is 16 tips in the book that will keep you alive and safe, even though it was intended for the trans community, but anybody could use those tips and keep themselves safe. So, yeah.
I did not know transgender people were unemployed at 3 times the rate of the general population.
Yes.
Household incomes are less than 10,000.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just flat out discrimination.
Yes, it is. It is. And then, so most of the trans girl who's not successful or work hard like myself, they are in these relationships with these men who keep them as their slave, you know, and because they have nowhere to go, so they're stuck in that relationship. So when COVID-19 came, these women are stuck in those homes with domestic violence, and it even got worse, you know, because they have nowhere else to go. They will be on the street, and so they stuck at home with the abuser, and it was so sad. So, you know, a few funders we have, we try to assist the girls with hotel or refer them to transitional housing. And in California, it's much better, but in other rural area like Detroit, Michigan, Texas and stuff, you know, the laws doesn't cover trans folks and stuff like that. There's so many murder since last year and this year. There have been almost 50 transgender murder. And go to my webpage, you will see all those information. Global trans, and then hyphen safety task TASKS4.org.
So, what are some of the safety tips in your book?
Number one, if you meet a person, be straight up front, you know, letting the people know that they're trans. You know, for example, the Asian girls, Latin girls, Filipino girls, they are small, petite, and they are very passable as females. So when they meet these boys at clubs, some of these boys are gangster, and, you know, they go to these hotels and stuff, we are disclosing to these men that they are trans. And when these men find out, and it's all bad, you know, and then we go and pick up the body from the hotel rooms, and some family don't want to be bothered with them. So then we have to have a memorial service, get them cremated and stuff like that. So then one of the safety tips is to be honest. And if you meet somebody for the first time, make sure you tell a friend or family member, meet with them in safe environment. Also carry phone numbers of a loved one if you get arrested. You're going to find 16 safety tips that would keep a trans individual alive. And those 16 tips are very, very important to the safety and well-being as trans and gender nonconforming folks. I just got back from 2 book signings. One was in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California. I also did a book signing in New York, and I'm speaking. I'm a motivational speaker, so I travel on this project. And then we have a lot of professors who have queer folks and stuff who order in boxes of the books. So, and I took part in the LA Times Book Festival. That was wonderful. The line was long around the building. And this book is the only transgender book that is out there, and so it caught a lot of attention, and there's quite a few money coming into the account.
Well, that's good, Grace. All right, listen, if anybody wants more information, just go to globaltrans-safetytaskforce.org. Maria Venegas is recuperating from a double mastectomy in San Bernardino and talking about her first published book entitled No Greater Joy.
Inspiration of No Greater Joy is just the finding my soulmate. I mean, to me, it was like finding that you've known forever. It's like it felt right. It felt like if you put on a used shoe and you're able to walk in it. And it also inspired me that every time people would ask, like, how did you meet? And we would talk about it. And they're like, oh, my God, it would bring tears to their eyes. Or it would be like, that is so crazy how you guys did that.
How long have you been married?
We've been married for 26 years. I decided to write about it because one day through pandemic, my house got flooded exactly that weekend where the state like got closed down. And it only left me one little room. And the five of us were stuck in this one little room waiting for the insurance to figure out what they were going to do with us. And so I was watching a commercial that from Page Publishing. And I just, you know, called in and I said, can I have some information? And they sent it to me and everything. And then after that, I just put it aside. And as a little bit of time went by, this lady, Tracy, calls me and she's like, hey, have you written a few words? Have you started your book? And I'm like, no. And she's like, just start, you know, just start. But she was the one that was actually pushing me to doing all that. And then one day she said, you know what, just do it, just do it. And I did. I started doing it. And then after that, it just took off. Gabriel and I, we've known each other since we were babies, but we never really even knew that. It's like one of those movies that you watch that you see people, you cross paths with somebody and you never really meet them. And until the time is right, that's exactly what happened with Gabriel and I, to where we kept bumping into each other. We knew the same people, but we never really met. And I think that's where it kind of got tricky, but weirded out, because it was like, oh my God, you know, when we started talking, we knew the same people. My godmother took care of him as a baby. And, you know, so she saw him grow up as well as she saw me grow up. So it was just things like that, that it was just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is like happening to us. Like, you know, because one day, I'm passing through, you know, my neighborhood and his friend was just barely moving in and he's just waving at me. And I'm like, who the hell is that? It was him and a bunch of other guys like at this corner house. So we just move on. And then after that, I happened to go through there because my cousin had called me. She lived right next door to him. And that's where I met him. And that's where we just started talking. And when we started talking, it just felt like I've known him forever. And we were inseparable ever since. Yeah, and then we just dated for like 3 weeks. And after the third week, we decided to get married. And we've been together ever since.
3 weeks?
3 weeks, yeah. He goes, you know what, let's go to Vegas. And I was like, okay, let's do it. And it was that weekend, the last weekend of June, that we went to Vegas. And again, it wasn't like one of those things where they propose to you or nothing. It was one of those like joking around, like, bet anything here that we're in Vegas that you won't marry me. And I'm like, you're on, let's do it. He's like, you serious? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it, you know?
Wow.
And yeah, and then he's like, so we went ahead and went through that. And that was it. We did it through there. And then after we did that, a year later, we decided to get married by church because that's what my parents wanted us to do.
Beautiful love story, Maria. Thank you. I hope you're back on your feet really soon. Marquita Brown grew up in Mississippi, where she started writing poetry in elementary school and then graduated to writing journals. And now she's published her first book entitled Broken Innocence, No Longer Pure.
At first, it started off as a poem and then it evolved into a book. I started writing it and then I just kept going. And I tried to publish it at one publishing company at first, but all of it rhymed like together. So they said that I had to put it in book form. So I changed it up and put it in book form. And I feel like my life can help other people. And I kept a journal. So I just went back into my journal and I picked out the stories that I wanted to share. And I wrote my book. My book is about me being raped at a young age. And I grew up with a lot of rage and anger inside me, and I didn't know where it was coming from. I was like 5 or 6 when it happened.
Who did it?
My dad was talking to this lady, and her brother did it when they left us at home, me and my brother at home with him. We were staying with them for the summer. He did it when my dad and his girlfriend was gone.
How do you know at 5? What's happening?
I didn't know at 5, but as I got older, I realized that, you know, it was wrong, and I wasn't the only person that in the world that it happened to.
Did you ever tell your dad?
Yeah, when I was like 20-something years old. He told me that he loved me and it wasn't anything that I did. And he told me that the guy was in jail and his brother was dead and his mom was dead.
Oh my gosh.
One of those, yeah.
How did you end up dealing with this? Did you have to get help?
Yeah, In school, I had a bad ankle problem in school. I would get suspended because I was in my own, like, I was to myself and I didn't bother people. But once someone bothered me, it triggered something in me and I had anger. My anger came out. It didn't matter if it was children or teachers or superintendents. When I was a senior, the principal made it mandatory that I go to get help or I would be expelled. So I ended up going to a place called, it was mental health at first, but now it's called Life Help. And I got therapy and on medication and stuff. But
did that help you?
No, writing helped. But I also ended up going to Chicago where I got into this group called Rape Victims Advocate. And it helped. It was overwhelming, but it helped. We had it every Monday. And then I went to the doctor and they said that I had bipolar too, but I thought I had bipolar. I still have problems with my anger and rage, but I'm going to go back to the doctor and try to get therapy because I've always been afraid to take the medication. Some of it was too strong. Some of it made me real sleepy. And some of it just didn't have no effect at all. I feel like I can help other people with my story. I have a YouTube channel that I started. And I also have an Instagram page with my link on it. And I also share on my Facebook page as well.
Marquita, I give you a lot of credit for sharing your story. Thank you. Heather Gio owns a real estate company in Louisiana, and instead of reading when she goes on vacation, she writes about her life as an unconventional mom and then realized she had enough stories to fill a book. It's entitled Crazy Tales of Miss Heather.
So I always was known for doing crazy things with my kids. Not the very typical scheduled mom, you know, never really had a bedtime, never really kind of had a certain thing we're supposed to eat. We were always the ones to make slime and play with Play-Doh and just kind of go with the flow. And so I kind of just kept track of all those things. And now with my kids being a little older, I don't get to do those fun things anymore. And so now I'm seeing myself doing them with my nieces and my nephews and my friends' kids. And so I kind of thought, you know, maybe this could be something. And so I kind of started writing down little things on paper and ideas. And before you knew it, I had probably close to 30 things, how to make easy things fun and keep your kids occupied and kind of use it as a guide and inspiration to kind of do some of the things that I talk about in the book. So I never left town, whether we were staying in a hotel or a beach house. I always had a roll of blue painter's tape and I always had a Ziploc bag of monster trucks. And so when we would get to wherever we were going, I would always cover the floors or an area in the house with painter's tape. And I would make roads and cities. And that would keep my kids occupied for so long because they would take their little trucks and they would just drive all around. That's probably kind of what started the kind of outside of the box events. I always had zip ties and clippies and scrunchies. And I was a hoarder of old sheets. And it would never cross my mind to just like not make a fort in the living room. And for about the first 7 years of my oldest son's life, I always had a mattress on the floor in my living room because whether we were like they wanted to wrestle or they wanted to jump or we built a fort or they wanted to sleep on a pallet, I was known for that house that always had a mattress on the floor in the living room.
Good for you.
I literally just got rid of that mattress about 3 months ago.
Did you keep changing sheets on it or?
I had sheets on it that matched the decor. my kids were real big into like WWE wrestling.
Yeah.
Every time there was a pay-per-view, we would go all out. And at one point, I built a wrestling ring in my living room. like it was above the ground, and I made like these posts. I sunk them in concrete buckets and I did bungee cords all around. And so that was like for WrestleMania that season, we had a wrestling ring and I would get plastic tablecloths and I would tape them to the ceilings and have them draped down and have walkthroughs and lights and music. And so that was every pay-per-view event we would go all out.
Kids must have loved coming to your house.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was always, I want to go to Miss Heather's. I have a costume closet. Like, I have a grown-up costume closet that, I mean, my niece every year for Christmas and birthdays would give me a costume because she would love that I would dress up with her. And so now it's become this thing where I've had a storage room in my garage built that's vented with AC and heat to where I have it all hung up and organized. And I probably have close to 100 costumes now.
Oh, that's great.
So, I mean, locally, I'm just putting it out there. I'm going to read to local classrooms. And then I've purchased like these blank books that every time I go do a reading or somewhere, I always give out a blank book and that as an inspiration to the kids. So like, look, just sit here and write your own book. So I've been doing a lot of classroom readings around town here, really promoting it on social media. In between the day job and the other and being a normal mom, that's how I'm promoting it locally here.
Heather, you're doing a great job. Everything you're supposed to do. I'll talk to you when you write your next book, all right? Constance Walker grew up in the UK and came to the US over 60 years ago. Now she's 92 years old and living in Cape May, New Jersey, where she weaves her love of animals and family into her book entitled Coyote Farewell, about two sisters who wind up with no one to turn to but an old cowboy for guidance after tragedy strikes.
You know, when you write a book, it's kind of an invitation to other people to start a conversation, you know. So I wrote about things which I think are important. It's a family book. It's about children. These children are not poor and not threatened particularly, but they have lost their home. Now they have to reinvent themselves. The only person they have is their father's ex-partner, an old cowboy called Dan, and he tries to steer them on the last day in their home when they're going up to go off with their mother to New York. So it's mostly about talking to children. It's also about their concern for their horses, you know, and how people try to look after each other.
Well, you talk of in your story about, you know, these sisters lose their dad and their brother and they have Dan, and Dan applies the understanding he has of handling young animals to dealing with these girls. And you say that the horses are threatened. How are the horses that they love threatened?
Well, first of all, they were scheduled to go to a sale, horse sale, the last day that the family was living in their old home. Then there was a fire and the horse sale was cancelled, and the horses, where the sales were cancelled, there was a man who bought horses to take to Mexico to be eaten, and so they're threatened. They eventually, Dan is allowed to, he wanted to buy them all along, but he couldn't because the mother, for some reason, was very angry with him. Anyway, the whole thing is that the story is, you know, stories are complicated. It unwinds as the book goes on. But I wrote it because I have something to say. I'm opening a conversation with other people about whatever happens that we have to deal with. And we can help each other if we talk. Not shout at each other, not bully each other, not get into politics, just family stuff, you know. I have a relationship with the library, and I just recently joined a group of writers that is that meets at the library, and I'm going to be pushing for a talk at the library about books and things, you know. Cape May Courthouse has an excellent one.
Excellent, Constance. You're on your way. Thank you. If nothing else, the pandemic gave us a lot of time. And between that and her cat, Rita Combos, a rheumatologist, took the opportunity to write a book she'd been thinking about for some time. It's entitled Corky the Cat.
And I always had a thing for colors and fashion and how the fashion industry is, you know, causing trouble with the planet. And the idea was in my head maybe for 4 years now, but then I finally got to sit down and put it in writing and make the pictures. Some of it is collages. Some of it is actual pictures, like photographs of Corky. And it's really cute, actually.
What kind of cat is Corky?
Corky is a tuxedo cat. She's a shelter cat, really. We rescued her from the Montville shelter in 2014. Yeah, she's 8 now. So the story is Corky has a special talent. She has an eye for colors. And she grows up to be a fashion designer slash editor slash influencer. And she's very popular and famous up until the pandemic hit. And then she's forced to stay home. And then eventually she figures out how to make the best out of it. She figures out that there are more important things in life than being famous and rich or having nice outfits. She takes up some hobbies and eventually she does well. She turns to music and cross-stitching, believe it or not, and appreciating nature, going out for walks.
Corky the cat does cross-stitch?
Yeah, in my book she does, yes. So it's actually a funny book. I didn't write it as a children's book. I have no background in being an author or in literature or anything. I'm a rheumatologist again. Yeah. So I have a full-time job. But when my kids were little, I used to make them stories, make up stories for them, and they used to enjoy it. So it's a hopeful message that slow down a little bit. If the pandemic didn't teach any of us anything, we don't have a heart or we're not sensitive. I don't know how to word it. But basically, she learns to slow down a little bit and enjoys the little things because that's where happiness is, not really. Again, the fancy thing, the parties, the success, Instagram, stuff like that. And I got some feedback from friends of mine that they enjoyed it more than their kids. Like reading, I have a friend who has a 5-year-old boy, and he enjoyed it more than his son. So,
okay.
It's really for anyone to read. It's not a kid's book necessarily, but it's a sweet story.
All right, Rita, thank you so much. And that's it for this edition of the Page Publishing Book Club. Download the podcast at 710WOR.com. I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. I'll catch you next time.